Hello Center Church, very happy to be with you. We are in our second message in this new series, which I anticipate will take us through the end of the calendar year, where we are taking, we're doing deep dives at this time into the parables of Jesus. So last week, in addition to introducing the function of parables at a literary level, at least briefly, we also set the stage for the parable of the Good Samaritan by reading the context that leads up to it, a very valuable interaction and instructive one between Jesus and this lawyer, this person who's learned in the law. Well, today, this week, we're going to conclude our discussion of the Good Samaritan by spending all of our time and paying all of our attention to the parable itself. I mentioned this last week. I'll mention it again this week. I want to highlight for a few reasons. One is to obviously give credit where it's due and acknowledge the scholarship that supports our work in building content at Center. And the other is just so to give you these resources so that you are able to look them up, are able to buy these books if you're so inclined. I use many resources for each of our messages. In this case, the vast majority of the content, as it did last week, came from Amy Jill Levine's book, Short Stories by Jesus, where she is a top-notch Jewish scholar. And I think I might have mentioned last week, I think she's out of Vanderbilt still. And many excellent books that she has produced over the years, and the majority of the analysis of the Good Samaritan comes from her work, Short Stories by Jesus, and I'll be quoting her directly throughout. But if you want to just kind of see really where much of this content came from, it's right there in her text. Additionally, Brad Young has been important in this parable and will be through all of the parables as essentially building foundation and groundwork. And Ben Witherington III, his commentaries are some of the best I've read ever, and those all are play a role today. So, part two, the Good Samaritan. I'm going to read all of the parable again, just to frame it for us. This is in Luke chapter 10, verse 25. And look, a certain lawyer stood up to test him, saying, "Teacher, by what deeds may I inherit life in the age or eternal life?" And he said to him, "What has been written in the law? How do you read it?" And in reply he said, "You shall love the Lord your God out of the whole of your heart, and the whole of your soul, and in the whole of your strength, and in the whole of your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You answer correctly. Do this, and you shall live." But he, wishing to vindicate himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Taking this up, Jesus said, and now we begin the parable. A certain man was going down from Jerusalem, and he fell among bandits, who stripped him and rained blows upon him, and went away, leaving him half dead. And by coincidence, a certain priest was going down by that road and, seeing him, passed by on the opposite side. And a Levite also, coming upon the place and seeing him, passed by on the opposite side. But a certain Samaritan on a journey came upon him and was inwardly moved with compassion. And approaching, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and setting him upon his own mount, he brought him to a lodge and cared for him. And taking out 2 denarii, on the following day he gave them to the keeper of the lodge and said, "Take care of him, and whatever you spend beyond this I shall repay you on my return." Who of these three, does it seem to you, became a neighbor to the man falling among bandits? And he said, "The one treating him with mercy." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." So there's the parable of the Good Samaritan. As I mentioned last week, different Center communities are probably going to want to handle this differently. Some of you will have listened to the podcast before you come together. Others of you, not at all. But it may be that you want to structure your conversations so that before we get into like my teaching and analysis of this, you have the opportunity to wrestle with it and think it through yourselves. I think there's definitely value in that, if that's the approach you choose. So I've organized my thinking on this across essentially three observations, and I'll just kind of walk through those one at a time. The first begins with verse 33. It reads, "But a certain Samaritan on a journey came upon him and was inwardly moved with compassion, and approaching bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and setting him upon his own mount, he brought him to a lodge and cared for him." So those of you who take notes over this content, the first observation I have is as follows. We are compelled to meet the needs of others. In many ways, quite obvious, but I think the ways in which Jesus expounds on this are critical. We are compelled to meet the needs of others. Put as a question, and really an imperative, if you don't rise to meet the needs of others, who will? This is a very real concern for Jesus. A very real concern as Jesus is speaking to a lawyer who, as I mentioned last week, is interested in adding eternity, adding heaven, adding eternal security to the list of the things that he's already secured for himself in life. Jesus is very concerned with this question. If you don't meet the needs of others, who will? And the parable forces the listeners then and now to not let that be a mere rhetorical question that is heard, seen as something that is overly religious or preachy, and then dismissed. It is a question that is not meant to be left in the abstract, but is meant to be understood and experienced in the particular. If you don't rise to meet the needs of others, who will? So we're going to flesh this out, this notion that we are compelled to meet the needs of others. And to do that, we'll have to dive in to the parable itself in some detail. So the first thing I think is worth noting is that the person that is attacked is an everyman. This is a person with whom we are meant to identify. And I'm going to bring that up a few times, and we'll circle back around to this idea that this everyman, this person that has been beaten savagely by these bandits, is meant to be understood in a fairly generic way. This person who falls among the robbers is intentionally nondescript. He could have been returning from Jerusalem after offering a temple sacrifice. This is certainly possible. He could have been merely visiting someone in Jericho. We don't know that he has been at the temple. He could have been rich or poor. He could have been in the priestly class. He could have been a layperson. These details are, well, they're left out. They're non-existent. And for that reason, we're given essentially a blank canvas onto which, and this is a feature at a literary level of great storytelling, just the right amount of detail so that we're given this, this blank slate onto which we can cast ourselves. There are many misteachings, and I'll be talking about some of the wrong ways of thinking about this parable along the way, some essentially corrections of things you might have heard over the years in various contexts, but it is wrong to understand this man with any particularity, to try to read what is simply not present in the parable into the parable. So to talk about the road for a second, it's a perfect setting for a parable of this kind. This road goes from Jerusalem to Jericho. It's this 18-mile path traveling from, you know, all roads lead up to Jerusalem, right? So it's this. So our characters are going down from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and it's 2,500 feet down to Jericho at sea level. In the 60s, the Romans paved this road so that they could siege Jerusalem. And it's on this road. It's a famous road. So Jesus begins the parable with an everyman with whom we are all supposed to identify, and places this everyman in this famous setting. It's on this road that David fled from Absalom. It's on this road that King Zedekiah escapes his captors in the Old Testament. In a way, all roads lead to Jerusalem, and all roads go down from it. This is a famous place, and it's one that is filled with more history than just the couple of examples I've just given. And in that way, one is allowed to let one's imagination build and make meanings and connections and associations with a shared religious history, a shared national identity. Jesus takes an everyman and places him in this very famous kind of geographic setting. So there are many wrong readings that you can find readily, not just from teachers and pastors now, but through church history. There are readings that are, as I warned last time, overly allegorical. So the priest and the Levite are the law and the prophets. The priest and the Levite represent the law and the prophets. And of course, that makes the Good Samaritan, Jesus himself, who offers resources, coins, representing baptism and the Eucharist. I mean, this is an interesting reading. It is not at all what an ancient audience would have understood. I mean, it's an interesting reading, certainly a wrong one. More familiar to many of you will be readings that are more modern, where, for example, a more progressive reading of this parable makes the robbers essentially like Jewish Robin Hoods, who are gathering money from the rich on the road and giving this money to the disaffected poor. So this is certainly wrong. Amy Jo Levine addresses it directly, identifying the fact that this word robbers, it clearly means these are not noble characters. First, they're ancillary. I mean, they are a function of the story to get us to the point of the story, which is all about the Samaritan and all about this man half dead on the side of the road. So first there's that, but also there's not only no evidence that these bandits are doing anything good. There's counter evidence for that. The Greek sitting behind the language, I mean, it clearly means armed, roving, violent gang members. Even arguably, depending on like where you want to observe that word in the New Testament or in Luke, these are people that may be described as without mercy. This is a violent group of people, however many, doing violence to an individual on the side of the road. This is another wrong reading. Other wrong readings were supposed to associate the priest and the Levite with an elite class. This is reading the parable through the lens of class structure. And Jesus does offer parables that deal with socioeconomics and with class structures and hierarchies. This just happens to not be one. The priest and the Levite are somehow elites, therefore villainous, therefore other. But this is unfounded. First, the Levite and the priests are inherit these positions are inherited positions based on family lineage, whether that be from Aaron or from Levi. And neither being a Levite nor being a priest implies wealth or high status. There are some priests who happen to have high status. We see this as we arrive at the Sanhedrin, as we're heading toward the crucifixion of Jesus, there are priests that have higher statuses than others, but generally speaking, priests, they worked, they were maybe better associated with like the middle class, but that may not even be really a fair picture. They were diverse, like many careers now are diverse, and there's no reason to think they have wealth or high status. Josephus mentions particularly poverty-stricken priests. It's a wrong reading. You know, the priests and the Levites, they're wealthy, they're elite, maybe not even just wealthy, but socially they're elitist, therefore they're villains, therefore they're others, and really the message here is don't be like them, is entirely reading this parable, frankly, incorrectly. And in fact, funnily enough, this if you approach that reading, it badly misses the point, which we will find. But probably, to save the most egregious wrong reading of this parable for last, the most prominent misreading of the parable of the Good Samaritan has to be about Jewish law. The priest and the Levite do not help this man half dead on the side of the road because of Jewish law. Because purity laws would have kept them from touching the body and would not have been able, and therefore they would not have been able to perform their priestly duties until a ritual cleansing. However, and it's really astounding. I have books on my shelf, and some of you have heard sermons, or you've been in an academic context and heard this interpretation. It's shocking how easy it is. You don't actually have to have tremendous expertise to debunk this wrong reading of the parable. I mean, in the first place, they're not going to the temple; they are leaving Jerusalem. So, ritual uncleanness happens all the time. I mean, it happens with some frequency for various reasons. And it's, why is that? Particularly if you're leaving the temple, if you're coming down from Jerusalem, which means that they're not about to make a sacrifice. They've certainly already, any sacrifices they would have made, they have already made. It's not particularly problematic if they become ritually unclean. It's a matter of engaging in the practices necessary to then become clean. They're leaving the temple, but also none of that's even relevant because the person is not dead, which is really the most curious mishandling of this passage. Even if they were going to the temple, which they weren't, but even if they were going to the temple, this is what is in fact so insulting about this reading, this wrong reading of the parable. It makes assumptions about the ancient world and the people who occupied it that are entirely unfair. There's something really very ethnocentric to this as well, which is to assume that other peoples, other religious systems that are unfamiliar or more alien or alien to our own behave in ways that are almost subhuman. Even if they were going to the temple, the supreme command to love one's neighbor would have absolutely required that they investigate and care for a person, the living person, or even a dead body, because of the value they placed on burial rituals. They would have taken care of that. And they would not have felt that it was some kind of conflict concerning ritual purity. They would have engaged, again, in the appropriate steps to make themselves ritually clean, but they would have absolutely considered a Levite or a priest, would have, you know, generically speaking, would have absolutely considered a person who is in need on the side of the road. So if a Levite or a priest, in the parable of Jesus that he offers on the Good Samaritan, if a Levite or a priest goes to the opposite side of the road and ignores somebody who is in need, clearly something else is happening. And so here, so again, this is the most prominent wrong-headed approach to the parable, and I think it's certainly prevalent. If you've grown up in religious communities, sorry to say, this is not a parable about purity. And if that is your background on this parable, it simply misses the brilliance of it. It totally misses the point. So to deviate for a moment and talk about parables as a literary form, be very cautious of any pastor, speaker, teacher who is essentially trading the richness, the complexity, the true brilliance of these parables for the always cheaper kind of clever reading, where it's merely about the fact that you've heard something maybe that you've never heard before, and there's zero sourcing to support it. Because this happens quite frequently with the parables, and also with the parable of the Good Samaritan. Remember, the lawyer, which we spent a week discussing the setting of this parable, it's not incidental. The lawyer is worried about eternal life. He's worried about life after the age. He's worried about life after death. Jesus is recentering the conversation, not on the lawyer's obsession with like procuring eternal life, but on someone dying in a ditch who's barely holding on to life right now. Lawyer, man who's learned in the law, you want to add eternal security to the list. What I am telling you is all around you are people who are suffering, who are dying in a ditch. Pay attention to the right thing, and it will free you to not be self-obsessed, to not be so self-interested. The first point, again, we are compelled to meet the needs of others. And if you don't rise to those needs, who will? Remember that the person attacked, again, is an everyman. This is the person, at one level of the reading, this is the person with whom we are meant to identify. And so as we're hearing the story, the question, who will help him, this implicit question in the text, frames the other question, which is, who will help me? Who would help me? Levine quotes Martin Luther King on this parable, who actually gives, you know, it's really interesting, somebody who so many scholars address this and miss it, but Martin Luther King really gives the most insightful kind of interpretation of the parable, the most human one, and it rings true. Here's the quote. "I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me," says King. "It's possible these men were afraid." And so the first question that the priest and Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? At one level, we are supposed to ask the question, if you don't meet his need, who will? If you don't meet the needs of others, who will? So, those of you who are thinking through this parable with us critically have to be asking the question that I was asking when I really began to dive into the parable for the first time many, many years ago, I think probably teaching it in a course, which is, well, I mean, if the priest and the Levite are, if this association is not meant to provoke thoughts about purity laws or something to say, if it's not saying something about ethnicity or religion, I mean, what's being said? Why the priest and the Levite? Why mention them at all? In this parable, like with many other parables and other great folk tales or short stories of this kind, it operates on the rule of three. So again, we're dealing with the literary nature of the parable. The first, the rule of three, and it's actually very familiar to us in our culture as well, the first two fail, and the third succeeds. Think about children's stories, right? The rule of three is everywhere. Three Little Pigs, I mean, something about porridge at one point in one story, and so on. In ancient Judaism, if a priest and a Levite walk into a bar, only one person ever follows. And that person is an Israelite. Again, if you're hearing a story in the ancient world, whether it's in the scriptures or elsewhere, and you meet a priest and a Levite, you can bet every penny you own who the third person you're going to meet will be, and that person will be not a Samaritan, but an Israelite. A couple of quick examples. Here's Ezra chapter 10, verse 5. So Ezra rose up and put the leading priests and Levites and all Israel under oath to do what had been suggested, and they took the oath. Or Nehemiah chapter 11, verse 3. These are the provincial leaders who settled in Jerusalem. Now some Israelites, priests, Levites, temple servants, and descendants of Solomon's servants, and it goes on. This is a common association because there is a religious and ethnic association that is a through line here. Priests, Levites, and Israelites. And so if you are a listener to this story and you can imagine a great storyteller crafting it, first the priest comes down the road and does not offer aid to the man in need. Then the Levite comes down the road and does not offer aid to the man in need. Then comes, and everybody is waiting for the Israelite to come down from the road from Jerusalem, and the Israelite will offer aid, and the parable will be explained, and it is anticipated. In the same way that the third pig builds a house of brick. I mean, these are shared cultural touchstones. If I say, like, if I reference Luke and Leia, you're thinking about Han, right? If I say Kirk and Spock, you're probably going to say McCoy, and I got to reference this one. It's for you, Brad. If I say Rocky and Colt, you're going to say Tum-Tum. That's a deep cultural touchstone that exactly two people in the entire community know. This is an expected feature. Priest, Levite, Israelite. But where the listeners are expecting the Israelite to succeed, he does not even feature in the story. And this leads to the insights that come from the fact that Jesus turns that story on his audience by replacing the expected Israelite with the Samaritan. And it leads to my second observation for our discussion today. The first was, we are compelled to meet the needs of others. The second, we must cultivate compassion that expands and endures. The parable spends much attention contrasting the Samaritan and the bandits, using quite a bit of detail, in fact, for such a short parable. And the word compassion is an important word, not only in this parable, but in all of Luke. And it's something that actually, it has tremendous payoff if we give it some attention as it shows up in this parable. The Samaritan shows compassion, which is used before in Luke. Jesus feels compassion in his guts, in the core of his being. It's a gut feeling. It's a reaction. It's this impulse. Jesus feels compassion at his core, in his guts, when he sees the widow of Nain and her sons at her son's funeral. He sees a woman mourning the loss of her son, and he has a first response, which is one of compassion. The father, the same word is used when the father feels it in his guts, when his prodigal son returns. It's this reaction. It's this immediate response. Extreme loss. This sense of extreme, an awareness of extreme loss and the need, the desire to bring wholeness. Jesus, fully God, fully man, but at once God himself has a sense of extreme loss, and God himself has the need, feels the need to bring wholeness. I could say much about this. I'll show restraint. But this picture of deity that the creator of the cosmos, transcendent through all of it, present through all of it, who rests and in that way persists through all of creation, the Spirit, God the Father, present in Jesus, feels it in his guts when his prodigal son returns. Extreme loss. God experiences extreme loss and feels the need to bring wholeness. This is a fascinating picture that we have of God the Father. And this is what the Samaritan, this is what, not what the Israelite experiences. This is not what the expected hero of the story would experience or does experience. This is what the Samaritan experiences. Jesus experiences the same thing. Fully man, fully God. Jesus experiences this. And in this parable, who else experiences this? The Samaritan experiences this. But this leads to, unfortunately, another misstep and another wrong reading of this highly complex parable. I'm going to quote Levine directly on this. The Samaritan's compassion then becomes, for many of today's interpreters, the hook by which the sermon functions. This is, unfortunately, the need for some teachers and speakers to look for the most compelling message as opposed to really plumbing the depths of the text and the richness of it, and rather like a catchier sermon is the trade-off. Like one would rather have that or something. Here's what she says. In a number of settings, the parable serves as a warning against prejudice. For example, the two who walk by are a pastor and a choir director, while the Samaritan is a gay man, an illegal immigrant, a person on parole, or any other victim of bigotry. The point in this reading is that the they are really nice and the we sometimes fail in our obligations to help, and that we too should have compassion on those who are mistreated. So it's fascinating because absolutely Jesus is always not only concerned with and has compassion for, but arguably is most concerned with and is most interested in those who are placed on the outside. The Bible is replete with passages that insist that if you follow Christ, if you are a part of the community of God, you not only do you make room for the immigrant, but you love them and you treat them as neighbor, as a part of the community. There's no shortage in the scriptures of caring about and placing high value on those people who are victims of various forms of bigotry or prejudice. But to insist that that is the Samaritan is to mishandle the parable, and the concern is it's to miss what's really going on in the parable, which is quite brilliant. I'll finish the quote from Levine here. But to understand the parable as its original audience did, we need to think of Samaritans less as oppressed but benevolent figures and more as the enemy, as those who did the oppressing or do the oppressing. From the perspective of the man in the ditch, Jewish listeners might balk at the idea of receiving Samaritan aid. They might have thought, I'd rather die than acknowledge that one from that group saved me. I do not want to acknowledge that a rapist has a human face. Or, I do not want to recognize that a murderer will be the one to rescue me. We should all be very cautious of appealing but ahistorical readings of these parables, because there may be truth in them, but they will not go as deep as the parable is attempting to take us. They won't take us where the parable is attempting to take us, which is always a place more radical, frankly, than any of us were comfortable with or are comfortable with. So who were the Samaritans? Samaria was previously known as Shechem. This is where Jacob's daughter was raped, Genesis 34. This is where Abimelech completes a political hit job on his rivals, Judges 8 and 9. This is where Ahab constructed an altar to Baal, 1 Kings 16. Samaria was is as rich a setting as the road from Jerusalem. Hear this, please. In the time of Jesus, Samaritans were totally opposed to the Jews. And in fact, the Jews also were opposed to the Samaritans. Both claimed to be true descendants of Abraham. Both claimed to know the correct reading of the Torah. Both claimed to be the true priesthood. Both claimed to contain within their borders true places of worship. So if you are a Jewish person listening to this parable, and the Israelite has no place in the story, and instead a Samaritan arrives, Jesus' audience, as well as Luke's readers, when they think of the idea of a good Samaritan, it is entirely, entirely unacceptable. It's oxymoronic. It is the same as saying a good murderer. It is impossible. It is for them, for his audience. It's like hearing the phrase a good rapist. It's an unacceptable turn in the story. And to be candid, this is how you know you're beginning to get closer to the meaning of Jesus in his parables. When you begin to think to yourself, I'm not sure I like this reading. I'm uncomfortable or unhappy with or provoked by or challenged by this reading. Now we're probably closer to something that Jesus was trying to get at. I have to tell you, I would rather a reading where this is all about the insider accepting help from the outsider, right? Someone in some kind of majority accepting help from somebody who has suffered from the majority. I find that reading to be much more palatable, probably because it contains certain kernels of truth and certain beautiful sentiments. This reading I find to be markedly more provocative. It's why, by the way, when Jesus meets a Samaritan woman at the well, that story is so provocative. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, you know the scene. It's a retelling, a reframing of Abraham's servant and Rebekah. And I'm sure, I mean, you've all seen The Prince of Egypt. It's a retelling of Moses and Zipporah, which, by the way, is a brilliant and fascinating relationship. You have Jesus identified as a bridegroom, which kind of solidifies the convention and the tradition, and it's radical because it's a Samaritan with whom Jesus is speaking. You have this Jewish man meeting a Samaritan woman at the well, and really fascinatingly, you get this a wedding of a sort where through the Samaritan woman, the entire village comes to accept Jesus. So you have Jesus building the church. You have Jesus as bridegroom, and isn't radical to us unless we explore it. But if we understand how the Samaritans were viewed, the parable takes on new light. Jesus and the woman at the well takes on the Samaritan woman at the well takes on new light, and we have to read beyond the misreading that the Samaritan is an outcast. There's clear evidence to the contrary. The Samaritan's clearly well resourced. The Samaritan seems to be able to go in the parable, go where he likes. He's networked. He sets up this. He positions this man who has been so badly beaten in this lodge to be taken care of. The radicalness of it is how the Jewish audience would have received the construct of the Samaritan. And it leads to my third point, which really does make meaning in many ways of the first two. The first point is we are compelled to meet the needs of others. The second point, we must cultivate compassion that expands and endures. And this is, of course, surrounding the use of the word compassion that shows up in Luke through this gut reaction on the part of the Samaritan, as well as the episodes of like these responses or immediate reactions on the part of Jesus, or in the parable of the prodigal son. This notion in point two, that extreme loss should be felt and responded to, and there's this need to bring wholeness. And the fact that an enemy of a Jewish audience like this, a Samaritan, has this experience, frames all of this. All of this is in some ways bringing us to point three. The final point, and I think this is where the parable is truly at its most brilliant, and it ties the others together. The final point is, we make our neighbors. That's a direct quote from Levine. The final observation is that we make our neighbors. And this, I think, is actually getting at the heart of what the parable is all about. The Samaritan makes a neighbor out of the innkeeper. The same way the Samaritan chooses to rely on the innkeeper, the person running this lodge, to take care of and to provide for a man nearly dead. The wounded man makes a neighbor out of the Samaritan. Don't you see the brilliance of this? It's the person that is most in need that makes a neighbor out of the person providing for the one in need. Notice how the bond of love is formed in these relationships. Again, it is the one who is in need accepting the much-needed help from another. That's the mechanism in this parable for love and unity. That is the parable for this deep sense of camaraderie and solidarity across religious, cultural boundaries, across bigotries. And that is where we get into some very incisive insights about our own heart and what it means for us to consider the neighbor. And that's what I would like to explore to begin to close our conversation. So let's think about mercy and compassion for a moment, because the language of both is present in the text. Verse 36, who of these three, does it seem to you, became a neighbor to the man falling among bandits? And he said, the one treating him with mercy. Jesus says to him, go and do likewise. This is where we see kind of the first and second observations coming together. First, we must tune in. We've had a few conversations in our last series with this. We need to tune in to a few things. One, we need to tune into the need. We need to dial in to the needs of others in our very midst and not see that or treat that as a cliche. We need to take that deadly seriously. What does mature Christianity look like in this kind of season? I want our community, and this is not a point of pride. It's just a hope I have as much for myself as just the members of our community. I want us to act in Christian wisdom when things are spiraling, and they are, not only in our culture, not only in our country, but in many ways globally. And what does it mean to live and act in wisdom? It means that we need to take with total seriousness the needs of others, and we need to be compelled to meet them. And that means, and this is what I was getting at a moment ago, that means that we need to trust, frankly, our emotional register. Like, we need to trust, whatever that even means, like, it's experienced emotionally and cognitively, but my point is that, like, we need to trust the moment when you're like, I am moved in my heart, I'm moved to my core, I'm moved in my guts. This needs to be addressed. This cannot be left as it is. And wherever that provokes you to go, you need to have, and this is as much to me as you, wherever that provokes us to go, we need to have the moral and ethical courage to go there. That, if that's all we take from this parable, it is correct, and it's in a sense enough, but that's not where Jesus stops. He asked the lawyer the question, and he said, verse 37, Jesus asks him, "Who of these three does it seem to you became a neighbor to the man falling among bandits?" And he said, "The one treating him with mercy." Compassion, this is where we get into Christian maturity. This is where we see the depth of the parable. Compassion must lead to mercy. The Samaritan acts as Jesus acts. The Samaritan feels compassion in his gut. But notice that it is an ongoing action. It is not just about intention. It is not just about a cognitive or an emotional catalyst where you have this, like, your heart wrenches and you wait for it to pass and you move on. No, Jesus is saying, again, it's exactly against where the lawyer began in the conversation. Remember, the lawyer is asking, what thing can I do? Can I donate an amount of money? Can I do a thing to get me into the thing I want to get? What do I need to do to place myself in a position where I will have eternal life among these other things? And Jesus says, you need to first experience compassion in the way your worst enemy, in the way this caricature, in a way the Samaritan does. And then you need to let that provoke you into ongoing mercy, this ongoing act of love and service. This is perhaps hardest to do in times like these. That is exactly what we're called to do. Jesus says, stop paying attention. Don't worry so much about the afterlife. Worry about bringing the kingdom of heaven into this life through provocation by compassion into ongoing mercy. Mercy is an act. If compassion is an internal experience, mercy is the outworking of that in physical and tangible ways. That is what Jesus is compelling the neighbor to do. And that's what Jesus is compelling the lawyer to do. And in fact, the parable brilliantly takes one final kind of step and cuts to the core, I think, of anybody listening. And it goes even deeper than that. And this is the final thing I'll say on point three. Point three is we make our neighbors. Here's what I would say to you by way of close. We often confuse seeing someone else as human, right? Which is to say, like, seeing someone who is an enemy or seeing someone who is other than us, we often confuse the idea of seeing them as neighbor with essentially pitying them. We conflate them. We see somebody as human, and what that really means for many people much of the time is pity and judgment masquerading as compassion. Pity and judgment masquerading as compassion. Well, you know, I'm going to treat them in a certain way. I'm going to treat them in a certain way. I'm going to be kind to them. But my word, good for me, because I know, in fact, how bad they are. I know, in fact, how heinous they are. I know, in fact, that they did this, said that, align with this group. Hear this, please. In spite of the fact that fill in the blank, right, is a horrible, monstrous person, I know deep down they are also a human. As in, they're a human, but barely. Do you see how that framing, how insidious it is, how easily it sneaks into the way we think about other people? I'm aware that I should love them because they are a human being. But I am at once judging them. And this is where it gets super tricky. Sometimes those judgments, those observations about the them are exactly correct. And that's why the parable is provocative. That's why people think they would love what Jesus has to say, but often really deep down don't. I'm gonna love them because I recognize they're human, but all of how I really think and feel about them is laced with judgment. How hard is it to let that go when the judgments are true? when your observations about their inappropriate behavior, about their wrong-headed allegiances, about whatever are in fact correct, this is where the parable cuts in to the core. You know, one way to recognize, please, this as we close, again, this third point, we make our neighbors. One way to recognize someone else's humanity, as the parable challenges us to do, without caveat, without exception, is to recognize that even the enemy has the potential to do good. And to let it really dig into our hearts and minds, even to go further, even the enemy may be the very one you someday will have to choose as a neighbor, because it will be, that enemy will be the very person that you need the most in a moment. And in fact, this may be the best thing for you. I don't know what hypotheticals to give to like illustrate this. But you find yourself in a situation where you are in a medical emergency and you're needing transportation in a world prior cell phones or something. Or maybe you're not. You find yourself in a situation where you are having a medical emergency, or your spouse is having a medical emergency, or your son or daughter is having a life-threatening emergency. And the person who first comes to your aid is someone you know has seriously wrong-headed views about choose your topic, who has seriously wrong allegiances about choose the current, you know, the current issue, any current issue that we're facing, and you know this person is in the wrong. One night ago, you were texting somebody else about how inhumane this person is, and maybe what you were saying is true about this person. But in the moment when true need is represented in your life, if that person or somebody like that person arrives to give aid, what we are faced with is a moment where we realize that even the enemy has a human face. And then we choose who our neighbor will be. And that is not a one-time moment. That is not in a moment. That's not like we choose it for a moment and as soon as they take us to the hospital, as soon as like things are like back to status quo, we can move on. That choosing, if you want to follow Jesus, that choosing is ongoing. It forces us to stay in messy and frankly unpleasant and totally undesirable relationships, because we truly believe that neighbor and enemy, that neighbor should ultimately encompass enemy, should swallow up the category of other. Many of us are simply not able to experience the power of this parable if we imagine ourselves as the person who has the resources to supply the need. Because I think so highly of the people in our community, and I know, I'm very confident that so many of you, even if it's somebody that you maybe rightly detest, and what I mean by rightly detest is that you detest, again, a position that they hold or a view that they have or, frankly, something that they've done. I know that even though many of you would feel that way about certain people, like either at the national level, at the international level, probably also locally, you would still help that person if they needed help. The parable cuts deeper than that because it's suggesting that how would you respond? How are you forced to see them if they genuinely and in love and in compassion and mercy offer you help in your moment of need? It's that humbling that makes the parable so provocative. I'm going to close with a quote from Levine, who modernizes the parable through her particular religious and ethnic lens. And so I'll read her closing to you, because I think it's worthwhile. Samaria today has various names, says Levine. The West Bank, Occupied Palestine, Greater Israel. To hear the parable today, we only need update the identity of the figures. I, referring to her, she's saying, I am an Israeli Jew on my way from Jerusalem to Jericho. And I am attacked by thieves, beaten, stripped, robbed, and left half dead in a ditch. Two people who should have stopped to help pass me by. The first, a Jewish medic from the Israel Defense Forces. The second, a member of the Israel-Palestine Mission Network of the Presbyterian Church USA. But the person who takes compassion on me and shows me mercy is a Palestinian Muslim whose sympathies lie with Hamas, a political party whose charter not only anticipates Israel's destruction, but also depicts Jews as subhuman demons responsible for all the world's problems. The parable of the good Hamas member might be difficult for people in support of Israel's existence. Were Jesus a Samaritan, we today have the parable of the good Jew. If people in the Middle East could picture this, we might have a better vision for choosing life. Can we finally agree that it is better to acknowledge the humanity and the potential to do good in the enemy rather than to choose death? We make our neighbors, and we do this through compassion, and we do this through mercy, and we do this by accepting that even our enemies are capable of good, and that in our time of need, it may be an enemy that comes to our aid. Center communities, I am so eager for us to come back together as a whole church. We continue to pray for that, and we continue to work to that, toward that. I'm so grateful that you remain committed to one another, committed to prayer, to Eucharist, to fellowship, to taking care of one another, and to frankly, to a devotion to the Scriptures and to a devotion, a commitment to those who are in need. And my hope and prayer for you after discussing this parable is that you remain open to making neighbors even when you have previously only seen enemies. Blessings. We'll talk again next week.